This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Welcome. My name is Dennis Muller from the Center for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. And with me is Julian Thomas, Professor Julian Thomas, Professor of Media and Communications at Swinburne. And next to him, Associate Professor Ali Rennie, also from Swinburne. And on the far side, Associate Professor Margaret Simons, who's the Director of the Center for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne Uni. We're going to have a discussion this afternoon about media policy, and the way we're going to do it is this. I'm going to, in taking each of my panelists in turn, I will ask them a kind of stimulus question, if you like, to get them started, and then I will, if necessary, ask them some follow-up questions as we go, and I'll shut them down after about 5 minutes, and then I've got a few points to make myself. And then after that, for about the last quarter of an hour, we'll open it up to the floor for questions, and you can ask any or all of us your questions. So I'll start with Julian. And Julian, could you just begin with a bit of an overview of what we know so far about the federal government's media policy changes, in particular the 75% reach rule and the 2 out of 3, and perhaps you might explain what they
are. Sure, Dennis, happy to do so, and great to be here talking about media policy again. I think the way you framed the question says a lot about the government's approach to this problem. Those of us in the trade have been talking about reform or putative reforms, potential reforms, the prospect of reform in media policy for decades, I'd say. So it's always interesting to see new governments trying to progress this agenda. But the way you put it in terms of the 75% rule and the 2 out of 3 rule, and I'll come to those, I think tells us something from the start, that this is at present, it has been a rather narrowly framed debate and a rather narrowly framed reform package, which is really about who can own what in the Australian media landscape, who is allowed to acquire different media firms, which media firms are allowed to merge, which are not. So it's very much a debate about ownership and control. And while we all know that ownership and control is very important for the whole media landscape in many, many ways, I think we'd probably also agree that it's not the only thing, and it may not be the only thing that those of us who are concerned about the future of journalism, the importance of news and information in Australian democracy, it may not be the only thing that we want to discuss or that we would want to be on the agenda for a media policy reform program. So I suppose that's my initial thoughts about it. To come to the detail of what the government's now proposing, and this is the second time they've had a go at this, they introduced legislation that was very similar in the last parliament, which lapsed with the double dissolution, and we're now seeing this come back again. So they're trying this with a new Senate, and it'll be very interesting to see what the reaction is there. But what they want to do is reasonably simple. They want to relax a number of restrictions that have been in place for many years over ownership of Australian media companies. So the first thing they're talking about, and forgive me if this is really common knowledge, but the first thing they want to do is relax this 75% rule, the so-called 75% rule, which is really about the extent of the Australian population that a media company can broadcast to. But the effect of the rule is the most important thing. The point of that rule has been to stop metro media businesses, TV companies in particular, from merging with the regional players. So we've had a regional system of broadcasters and a metropolitan one. So the big metropolitan TV networks have been prevented from acquiring the smaller regional players by this 75% rule. What's what's undermined that rule very dramatically in the last few years has been, of course, the emergence of streaming as a significant supplementary sort of platform for the broadcasters, and streaming services, you're all familiar with them, whether they're in catch-up form or live streaming, are provided by all the major broadcasters now, and clearly they do not respect the boundaries of licence areas. So they're national services. They're often geo-blocked to Australia, so many of them are only accessible in Australia, but they're certainly not limited in terms of where they can be accessed inside Australia. So streaming has really substantially undermined the effectiveness and the rationale of that 75% rule. And so the government's proposal to remove that has not actually met with a lot of argument or contention. The 2 out of 3 rule that you mentioned, the other major restriction, is the restriction that the cross-media ownership restrictions that we're more familiar with that apply in our big markets, and they're basically about whether TV companies, radio broadcasters, and print can be cross-owned or not. And that's been prevented. It's to a 2 out of 3 situation, so we're familiar with, for example, Fairfax having an interest in radio but not being in TV. We're familiar with the fact that news has been prevented from acquiring a TV network by these rules. So these have had a significant influence on the shape of our media industries and the nature of our media businesses for many years. And go right back to Paul Keating's changes to the law in his era as treasurer. So they've been there for a long time. The question again about these rules, of course, is that by focusing on those three media platforms, print, radio, and TV, they're missing out on all those new media platforms that have developed so strongly in the last 20 or 30 years. So the question is their relevance in an environment where more and more people are moving to other platforms altogether. First we had pay TV, but that is now looking like an old media platform. We're now, of course, in an internet era, and the question of the relevance of the 2 out of 3 is a very real one. So there, that's really what's on the table. The government's made some suggestions, proposed some rules which they argue would help preserve local content in regional broadcasting, which they see as important and which are clearly politically really important for this to get through the Senate and to have the support of nationals and regional parliamentarians. It's always been a very hot, very contentious issue in regional Australia. So they're attempting to satisfy people's demands for local content through an elaboration of the points system, which is currently in place. And that's intended to make sure that there's still local content. Whether that actually assures us that there may be strong local news is another matter altogether, and something we might want to talk about.
Thanks very much, Julian. And that actually is a nice connection, a nice segue, I think they say, into you, Ali, because what I'd like to start by asking you is, what do you see as the major issues in media policy as it affects community radio, or community media, I should say?
Community media generally. I should say that I'm a board member of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, which administers, around $16 million of Commonwealth funding to some 400-odd community broadcasters across the country. I'm not speaking from that perspective or for them, but the experience of restructuring that organisation intensively over the last couple of years, I think certainly has caused me to think about Australia's media ecosystem and the role of community and Indigenous broadcasting in that and where the kind of policy deficits are right now. Look, I think the current proposed media reforms are essentially lazy in what they're doing in order to address Australian content. Australia has a thriving community media sector, which I think is being left to languish, both from an infrastructure and spectrum perspective, but also in terms of how we think about Australian content and how you nurture that from the grassroots. So some of the policy issues and decisions that are concerning us right now in that sector are around, for instance, regional digital radio, which is now, you know, being planned. And yet, so community radio has received funding for digital radio transmission and related activities in the five metropolitan cities where we've had it for some time. But it's been seeing cuts in those areas, I think $1.4 million in the last federal budget from the digital radio program. And we're not hearing any plans about how infrastructure for digital radio in regional areas for the community sector is going to be addressed. And it's not cheap technology, and there needs to be a plan. More than 5 million Australians listen to community radio in an average week. This is not a marginal sector, and they listen for some 16 hours on average. I think it's about 800,000 Australians only listen to community radio. And, of course, community TV has been kicked off the free-to-air spectrum on this assumption that the internet is the place for grassroots amateur content. Of course, the internet is a place for grassroots amateur content, but there's, you know, the business models and the ways, the means and pathways to sustain content distribution platforms are not clear at the moment. It was a premature decision and not necessary at the time. So for me, that raises a lot of questions around, you know, the government's assumptions about opportunity cost, that spectrum's not ready to be used, for instance, for mobile broadband at this point in time. So it was premature for that reason. But of course, you know, it may be the case that we see community and other broadcast services moving to online distribution. If that's the case, you know, I think there are serious questions we need to be asking around what does free to receive mean now? Should we be thinking about unmetered content streaming for services like the ABC or community services? And I think really for me, the issue of content is important. We fund content through the Community Broadcasting Foundation and have been looking very hard at, you know, how do you increase capacity, particularly in regional areas, so that producers there can start to produce, you know, quality, meaningful content for their communities. That there's a need for more training. There's a need for better resourcing, but we can't forget that stations themselves, the organisations that support these efforts, also need support and infrastructure.
Ali, does this have implications also for Indigenous media?
Yeah, so the Indigenous media sector is largely funded through the Indigenous Advancement Strategy through PM&C, but we've seen no increases in the funding since it shifted out of communications and into that portfolio. I don't think that there will be any. It's a hard call when it's in there with health and education and all kinds of other Indigenous services to say that this should be supported over those other budget items. So it's kind of been basically legacy levels of funding since it moved to IAS.
Was there a rationale for that move?
It was part of a broader move by Tony Abbott to merge all Indigenous funding into five funding areas. So one of them involves culture, which is where community broadcasting services tend to fall. And what's been interesting for me recently is that the Indigenous Remote Communications Association, together with McNair Ingenuity, have carried out a survey in remote communities I think it was they could only manage to about 200 individuals because it, you know, you have to do, as I know through my other areas of research, you have to do it face to face when you're surveying people in remote areas and use local people when you're doing it. But it was 11 communities, I think, and 200 people from memory. And they found that there's a, you know, well over 9 out of 10, like kind of almost 10 out of 10 in the high 90s, you know, awareness of Indigenous radio services and very high listenership. So that's of local Indigenous radio networks, but also ICTV, Indigenous Community Television, which is the grassroots community service which moved onto the VAST satellite platform when Indigenous terrestrial services were taken away with the shift to digital TV. So that it's now a kind of aggregated satellite service that satellite direct to home viewers receive. And these services are incredibly important, but, yeah, not seeing any increases in support or funding or attention.
Okay. Thanks, Ali. Margaret, we've heard both from Julian and from Ali some pretty diverse issues around broad media ownership, about metropolitan markets, regional markets, and now Indigenous and community media. What approach do you think overall, looking, I suppose, in a very broad sense, what approach to media policy would you like to see the Commonwealth taking?
Well, an approach would be good.
An approach would be good.
I mean, I think if we think of policy as actually a connected set of ideas about where you're wanting to take an area of the nation's endeavour, we haven't really got a media policy and we haven't had one for a very long time. What we have is a lot of fiddling with rules, as Julian eloquently put it, that are to do with ownership and to do with power. The whole thing has been craven in terms of pandering to the media empires. And this is the case for a long while. If we think back, you know, when did we last actually have creative media policy, which was thinking positively about it, what it was possible to do with the immensely important asset of the media, and the ABC included, but not certainly not only the ABC. You know, it's really hard to think when that was. I was thinking about this last night, and maybe we could argue on the community broadcasting area, Tony Staley during the Fraser government, who actually introduced community broadcasting. That's really the last creative act I can think of. And that's an extraordinary thing. Also, the creation of SBS at around in the same government. And more than most areas of policy, this area has been corrupt and lacking in imagination and vision. But now, you know, now is the moment. We have the end of the media empires, a reduction in their influence, enormous new tools for distributing media content, and there is a wealth of opportunity there and an enormous lack of creative thinking to match that opportunity. Now, you know, I'm not saying I have the answers, but here are some things that I would like people to be thinking of. Obviously, and we spent a lot of time talking about this at the New News conference, journalism, as we have known it, is in a moment of immense crisis and opportunity in equal measure. Now, in any other area of industry policy, you would expect government to be thinking, well, what can government usefully do in this area? It doesn't, obviously, it would be obnoxious for the government to be interfering in the newsrooms in terms of what the content is. But what about tax-deductible status for not-for-profit investigative journalism, no matter how it's carried out? What about encouragement for citizens in local communities who start up their own web-based media outlets? That wouldn't necessarily have to be money. It might be a matter of training hubs in community centres where those who can write could learn to build a website, or those who can build a website could learn to write, or some combination of that. Or studios for doing podcasting, which would be accessible through community centres. You know, these things would not be very expensive, but would mean the world to the many new media entrepreneurs coming from all sorts of different sectors who are thinking, well, you know, I think I could do something here, but I don't have the skill set or whatever. I think also the ABC is obviously very important, and public broadcasting generally, also the SBS. It's a long while since we have heard from government or the board a clear and creative vision for what the ABC might be in the new media age. And we heard from Michelle Guthrie last night talking about the importance of new distribution methods. I think she's exactly right about that. But that's only one, you know, small part of it. We didn't hear very much about the content. And, you know, I think it would be good to hear more about that. One thing about media policy has been the way the ABC board is appointed. Stephen Conroy in the Labor government changed that method to sort of end the very long tradition of stacking of the ABC board, which both sides of politics have indulged in. But what we now have is a sort of corporate culture stack. Not many people who understand content, and people like Jim Spiegelman are going to stand down very soon. And, you know, they all come from pretty much the same sort of circle, and not many of them really understand media content. I think that's a real worry in terms of the future robustness of the ABC. So, you know, there's a huge raft of opportunities there. And I think if there was any other area of industry policy that was so important to the health of the nation and the civic health of the nation, you know, if it was education or libraries or anything of that sort, you would see government and bureaucrats and so on actually trying to think creatively. Whereas what we've got is a bit of fiddling with the rules, which nobody can really argue with because they are so obviously out of date. I mean, massively out of date, the existing rules. So we're all thinking, yes, reform is needed. But, you know, it's really fiddling at the edges, and I think this is an area of government policy that's just enormously, distressingly unimaginative, lazy and frightened.
Julian, you seem busting to speak.
I was just sort of thinking of additional adjectives. I thought you were going to say sclerotic.
Do you disagree with my adjectives, Julian?
No, I don't, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. But I suppose I think that we've got something like 20% of a media policy. I do agree it's kind of lazy. But I suppose I do think that it is important, even though like it's very uninspiring. But it raises the question, which I do think people, you know, should consider, which is, as well as, I mean, in addition to what we know about the vitality and promise of the community and Indigenous sectors and what we know about the importance of the ABC, there is a real question now about what does the future of Australia's commercial news media look like? I mean, do we think it has one at all? And so to the extent that the reforms are important and do merit attention, I think they do, despite everything we've said, it's because of this. It's because we actually do need to think about this. There are still a lot of journalists in the commercial sector, and I don't think we want to have a landscape where everything is not for profit, where everything is in the public sector, where everything is in the community sector. That's not the sort of ecology which Tony Staley imagined, that was for sure, and it's not the kind of ecology that would be helpful now. I think we all want to have a strong commercial sector alongside those things. That's a key part of the structural diversity that we need. I do agree with Ellie and Margaret's points about the limited scope and ambition of the government's agenda, and wouldn't it be wonderful to see something more ambitious there? I mean, one thing, though, that has sort of held us back in this space is that, I mean, we're still proceeding on the basis of a rather alarming lack of knowledge about the actual problems that are right in front of us. So if we are concerned about diversity and plurality in this sector, it'd be actually really good to know how much there is and to keep an eye on that. So I don't know if there's anybody here who's interested in research or working on this sort of problem, but something I'd certainly be really interested in. Why don't we have a regular audit of media diversity and plurality in Australia? In other jurisdictions, in the UK, for example, Ofcom's done some really interesting work on how you might do that. It's not just about availability of different sources through the internet. That's part of it, but there's a lot more to it than all of that. It's also about, well, where do people actually go for content? What do they want? Do they, you know, we know they want local content. We know they want some good options with all of this stuff. But what are they actually doing? And also, what's the quality of the news and information thereafter? Mm. You know, and how are we protecting that? Are we doing that well enough? So I suppose I'd to sort of add to our wish list, as it were, of things that governments or other people, for that matter, could usefully do in this space, and that I think would bolster our arguments around possible futures for commercial media as well as other sectors. I think that sort of work's really important.
Yeah, I just want to come in on this question of public versus private. I mean, one thing that we think about a lot at the moment in the community sector is, what is community online? At the moment, the definitions of community broadcasting are very much, you know, enshrined in legislation around the need for community participation, community boards, that it must have Australian content, et cetera, et cetera. Limits on advertising, it has to be called sponsorship for a start. And that's been important to differentiate community broadcasting from commercial services. And I have to say, particularly in regional areas, those lines can become very blurred unless there are regulations in place to ensure that these are community-owned and operated services. And, you know, now...
What are the big problems there?
Well, for instance, some stations will take John Laws and rebroadcast that. you know, like there... I mean, or, you know, community TV, when it was on open narrowcasting licences, you know, was doing a lot of paid programming with Harness Racing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been an ongoing issue. Because these are services that are trying to support themselves, I think they should be allowed to advertise, but they need to be non-profit organisations. But once they move into an online environment, those regulations can't be really enforced. And there's nothing to stop probably these community TV channels, you know, supporting themselves off the back of four porn channels if they wanted to now, to be honest. Right. And that's kind of what Malcolm Turnbull is saying they should be doing. and that's, you know, that's concerning for me, because I think that this media is there for a reason, and it's there for community participation, it's there for localism, it's there as an alternative, it's there for kind of grassroots innovation. And that temptation to just become networked and commercial in orientation is there, and it's not going to go away. So, you know, for us as a funding organisation, we think about this a lot because, for instance, I mentioned that the Indigenous free-to-air transmitters in remote areas were turned off. We had to go to the government and say, can we direct our funding to this satellite ICTV service when it has no community broadcasting licence? There's never been a community broadcasting licence for satellite services. And that's going to be increasing the reality.
They said yes.
Because they recognised that it was, you know, a not-for-profit organisation with membership that was operating at four communities. But we really need at least some kind of self-regulation in this area as a sector. And, you know, it's really interesting to think about what happens with radio services if it becomes more efficient in smaller markets or with, say, sub-metro community radio for it to be distributed over mobile. And an app, for instance, you might not even know the difference as to whether it's digital, terrestrial or mobile delivered. Or say in a car receiver that's receiving digital, terrestrial and mobile radio services, all these, you know, the way that consumers receive it, there might not be much to differentiate it. But it does matter in terms of policy and regulation.
Yeah. Well, mentioning regulation allows me to have a little bit of a say for a moment, because one of my particular interests is on the issue of media accountability. And I've been concerned for a long time about the way in which the media industry, is restructuring, so that we have a situation now in which big telcos like Telstra and so on are becoming media companies, partly because of this conjoining of distribution and content, this necessary conjoining. Mm. So now we're seeing, I suppose, the paradigm case in America with Time Warner and AT&T. But here, Optus and Telstra and the other telco companies are now becoming increasingly media companies, and that raises for me a major question around the structure of regulation, because we have already this anomaly that news and current affairs on electronic media, on television and radio, is actually the subject of government licensing. And I invite you to just to think on that for a minute. We haven't had licensing of newspapers ever in Australia, and there hasn't been licensing of newspapers in Western democracies since the abolition of press licensing in England in about 1689. But nonetheless, as an accident of history, we have we've had licensing of radio and TV news and current affairs since the inception of radio in 1922. And this would seem to me, to take Meg's point about opportunities, here's an opportunity to stand back and look at the structure of media now and to have a root and branch reform of the regulatory framework with a particular necessity, in my view, to separate news and current affairs media and their accountability, their line of accountability, from the licensing and accountability structures for the media industry as a whole. So thank you for opening that up for me. But you were talking about this question of sustainability, really, about community sector. But I noticed also in that area that SBS recently have done this deal to take the Viceland service. That's a bit of a step towards trying to make public into commercial, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel a little bit angry about that one myself. For those of you that aren't aware, SBS outbid Channel 9 for content from Vice, so it's going to be called the Viceland channel on SBS.
Could you just tell us what it is?
Yeah, so Vice is really interesting.
It's not porn, is it?
No. Actually, some of it would be close. infamous fashion photographer called Terry Richardson has done some stuff with Vice, which kind of borders on pornography. But it's a... So it started in Montreal in, I think, 1994 with a government grant as street media and youth media. And if you think about the OSCO cuts to youth media, where is our future Vice land going to come from if we're cutting youth media? But has grown to be, I think, worth in the order of $2 billion as a media company. It's extraordinary. Now based in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And it does, I suppose, somewhat irreverent youth content. I've always found it interesting because it's really used the user-generated aesthetic and user contributions in a way that no one was doing at the time, back in the late 90s and early 2000s. But I suppose what makes me angry about it, because I do like Vice, I like the content, but we would have had it anyway because Channel 9 were willing to pay for it, and now public funds are being used to acquire this international content. So I'm not sure that that's the role of a public service broadcaster, particularly in an age where, as Meg says, there's a real need for funding of quality news.
Mm. Mm. Cool. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And this is part of what I mean about, a lack of creative thinking about, the immense asset of public broadcasting in Australia. It is one of the things that is different between us and many European countries and us in the United States, particularly in terms of journalistic futures, that we have this really strong tradition of publicly funded broadcasting, including news and journalism, but not only, of course. I think it's enormously important. It's one of the things that is key to our national character. But we can't just sort of set and forget. Everything is changing in media. We really need to think, OK, we've got this wonderful asset. How do we use it creatively and with vision? And yes, simply spending public money on outbidding a commercial broadcaster is lazy and unimaginative thinking.
Hmm. You were saying earlier about various possibilities for enhancing the breadth of media, so perhaps with not-for-profits and so on, and the possibility of some form of government funding, either by tax cuts or perhaps, did you have in mind any sort of direct government financial support?
Yes, and there's a number of different ways in which direct government support could be given if that decision was made. And I realise there's all sorts of debates about whether it should be or not. There's always concerns about government funding and whether it comes with government control attached, but one of the other strengths we have is quite a strong convention that the ABC is independent of government, although funded by it, and we could build on that.
Yep.
But for example, the ABC is already in a sense commissioned by the public, and we now have all these mechanisms that we've been talking about earlier today in which the public can directly talk to a media organisation and to an individual journalist. Well, you could extend that model. You could actually have a commissioning model where groups of the public brought together through social media can actually say, well, actually, we need a documentary on what's happening to our local school in Shepparton or Bendigo or something of that sort. You know, that's something creative you could do either with the ABC or with community broadcasting subsidised by government or with some sort of system of grants.
So that's some sort of kind of Arts Council type arrangement.
Yes, that sort of thing. Now, we have the ABC, and it would seem to me that it would be, you know, not a radical step for the ABC to step into that space, but there would be other ways of doing it as well.
Well, it'd be possible, you would think, to have, in a sense, a parallel ABC Act, you know, an act with equivalent guarantees of independence and so on, that would allow funding to be disconnected, if you like, from government influence, although perhaps you wouldn't want to fund it through the Attorney General's office.
Well, that's true. But also just picking up on Julian and Ellie's point about Indigenous media, we've had a workshop here on Thursday and a roundtable session and then a panel session the other day from Indigenous people who are making incredibly creative use of new and social media, things like Indigenous X, which is leading to voices being heard that in ways that hasn't been previously possible. And they're not in receipt of any government money. They don't have broadcasting licences or anything, and yet we're beginning to see those voices amplified. And to answer Julian's point, of course, we've done some research around how many of these outlets there are and are building an app and a database around that at the centre. But, you know, I mean, Indigenous media isn't the only case where you have groups of people who are now able to make their voices heard in new ways. We found, for example, in some of our research, Dennis, as you know, that social media has actually caused changes in news agendas in some specific areas, in particular newsrooms, and particularly in the reporting of violence against women. You know, so there's immense possibilities there for fostering and encouraging a healthier and more democratic citizenry involvement in media. And I'm not only talking about citizen journalism, although that is part of what I mean.
Yeah. Julian, do you want to add to respond to that?
No, I think they're great ideas. I think actually the sort of longer story of Australian media policy and the sort of system is this story of remarkable vitality and innovation emerging from the edges of the system in different ways, from the community sector, from the Indigenous sector, from non-profits, from start-ups. And you can see that going back 20, 30 years. And I think it's a reflection on the intensely restrictive nature of our policy structures overall. And I think it also suggests to me the potential, what could be possible if we were able to free things up a bit.
Seems to me that what we've got with this, coming back to the beginning where you talked about the 75% and the 2 out of 3 rules, what we've finished up with, in a sense, is the rump of the possibilities that was left after all of the horse trading that was going on in Canberra between the media companies and the government, and not just the media companies as a monolithic whole, but a whole bunch of factions within them, deals or attempted deals about the so-called anti-siphoning laws, which are designed to protect, you know, the grand final and other big sporting events from just being hived off onto pay television. So there was arguments about this anti-siphoning legislation. There were arguments about who might be able to take over whom, and the regional television people were fighting like Kilkenny cats among themselves and then sometimes with their metropolitan counterparts. And so it seems to me what we finished up with was this, you know, the two things that everybody could at least not disagree on.
That's right. But the problem is that they, in themselves, they probably don't go terribly far. And we're probably addressing the problems from kind of 10 or 20 years ago now, eventually, late, but we're not really addressing what's new. It is a reaction, as I think you're saying, to a very long, drawn-out and very fraught political process. I mean, it's not that long ago prior to the election of the coalition in 2013, that the Labor government was proposing a much more ambitious and more sweeping set of media reforms. They wanted a convergent regulator that would include all of those internet platforms that you were talking about, Dennis, and a whole range of other things. And that I think in the last round of committee meetings for the communications, the Parliamentary Communications Committee, Scott Ludlam described that as a traumatic experience. He said he still couldn't really get over that, the history of dealing with that 3 or 4 years ago. So now we're left with this residual set of measures. They are important, but they're uninspiring, and they're not going to help a great deal if we're in their own terms. If we're really thinking about where journalism's going,
I'm thinking about on the scale that Meg was talking about. Certainly.
Indeed, yeah.
Do you want to?
I just wanted to come in on a slightly tangential point around how people receive their media and media policies related to. Infrastructure, because I mentioned before this Indigenous service ICTV, which went up onto the VAR satellite service, and I also mentioned an IRCA survey. One thing that was really interesting in that survey is that they found that 50% of homes actually didn't have they weren't able to receive TV.
Who's IRCA?
So IRCA, this was the Indigenous Remote Communications Association. So in their survey of Indigenous households and consumers and audiences in remote communities, they found that 50% of homes actually didn't have a satellite dish that was either working or one at all, because people move homes, because of the conditions out there, the expense of replacing this equipment, even though it was initially subsidised. Consumers then have to pay if they move house or if they need a repairs to it. So it's kind of interesting, because if we also know from our other research that Indigenous homes in remote areas are very unlikely to have a home internet connection either. So there are serious questions around how these media policies, which were designed at the time to deal with the costs of digital TV and moving to digital transmission, where you could argue it wasn't absolutely necessary for these very remote areas, and which has had this flow-on effect where some people aren't, probably, we don't know how many, but a significant amount of people aren't actually getting a television service in Australia.
Extraordinary.
I mean,
that really does go to a big social policy question about equality of opportunity and access to information, because the information gap is now becoming a metric in basically socioeconomic status.
Yeah, and the NBN has not resolved that, because the retail mechanism doesn't suit remote living Indigenous people because they preferred prepaid services. And in fact, video content, if you're on a prepaid mobile service, if you have reception, which is not that many areas in very remote Australia, is a lot more expensive than if you've got a home connection.
Mm.
So, yeah, they're really not receiving anything.
Yeah, and a related question, coming back to something Julian mentioned earlier on about the system of awarding points for localism, local news and current affairs, there's a huge gap in that proposition, because no one, as best that I can work it out, has been able to define what it means to be local. So would it be sufficient, for instance, if you had a television licence for Bendigo, would Warrnambool still be local? And that's an issue which, when I spoke to the Senate committee about this, they clearly hadn't thought about. So how local is local? What does the word mean? So if you're going to have a point system, then it's got the criteria for awarding the points need to be spelled out, and they simply haven't been. So part of the same problem.
And the other possibility under that point system is that you could have the Warrnambool mayor, for example, being interviewed by a journalist in Melbourne who knows nothing about Warrnambool or what the questions should be, but because it's a local figure and broadcast on a local station, it counts for the points. Or that seems to be possible, at least on what we know.
I think on what we know that would be possible. I mean, already we've seen WIN television newsroom shift from Mildura to Wollongong. So they're basically covering northern Victoria out of Wollongong. So that's like covering Berlin from Paris, basically.
Mm-hmm. Just on that as well, I mean, I'm not convinced that the point system would be restricted to, news and information, local news in the sort of sense that you have in mind. I think it could easily cover a much broader category of local content, which might be a local cooking show or something like that. And, of course, not suggesting that they're not
cooking
good
shows
things.
Not important.
Not very important, they are. But they're not necessarily what we've got in mind when we're thinking about the kind of civic and democratic importance of the job of journalism in those communities.
Sure. Well, at being quarter past the hour, it's your turn. If you have questions, please put your hand up. We have a couple of roving microphones, and please hold your fire till you've got your microphone in front of you. There's somebody down here at the front.
Hi, Margaret. You had some very interesting, well-thought-out ideas for media policy and developing it and fleshing it out. Have you advanced any of these ideas to the federal government? I know it sounds like hitting your head against a brick wall sometimes, but sometimes it's worth doing and persisting.
Well, one of the dispiriting things, we were discussing this in the green room earlier, one of the dispiriting things about talking about media policy, which I think we all think it's important to do, but it's not the sort of thing which gets the pulse racing, is that nothing moves. Now, over the last 10 years, I think I have given evidence to 2 or 3 inquiries of different sorts into the media. There was the Finkelstein inquiry, there was a two Senate committee inquiries I've given evidence to, and there was another one as well, and all of them have been stillborn. It seems to be, you know, the kiss of death, really, to start a media inquiry. You're going to lose government within weeks.
It gets worse than that. I worked for the Finkelstein inquiry, and I was likened to Stalin, Mao Zedong, and some other tyrant.
So, you know, governments propose changes, mostly, as we have described, unimaginative changes. The Finkelstein inquiry, which looked specifically at journalistic standards, was much more narrow and came up with a very specific set of recommendations, not all of which I agreed with. And then it goes to some Senate committee or whatever, and we roll up pretty regularly, frankly. I mean, with a, you know, sort of beginning a bit predictable, isn't it?
We're on
a
regular side.
I think they're getting sick of us.
Yeah.
And we say things like we've said here today and a few other things as well. And we get asked reasonably intelligent questions, and sometimes these committees even come up with reasonably intelligent reports, and then nothing happens.
I think that you just pointed to the whole problem of inquiries and committees and so forth. Just get bogged down in a whole lot of red tape for years on end, and nothing changes. I thought something like a more direct approach to the former communications minister, now prime minister, since you have some very nimble, agile, innovative ideas to communicate, and they're obviously terribly bereft of ideas of their own.
Yeah. I think it's a bigger problem than red tape. The media industry, the media proprietors are an immensely powerful lobby group, immensely powerful. And if you want to get policy which runs against their interests, you are basically, I think, submitting yourself to the curse of Sisyphus. You know, you push the boulder up the hill and it'll run back and crush you.
No, it's. I mean, I think it is this area specifically which is both difficult because of the huge political stakes and the huge money stakes, and also because it's the last thing politicians really want to tackle and to think creatively about. So I don't think it's committees in general. I do think this area specifically is extremely difficult. And it's dispiriting to be talking about the same things that we talked about last year and the year before that, and really between us have probably been talking about since at least the early 2000s. And certainly in Julian's case, Julian worked on a Productivity Commission report which made some terrific recommendations, not one of which was implemented.
There was somebody out here.
Yeah, the question's for Ali, or perhaps all the panel as well, around remote communities and the equity issues to do with educational literacy. Have those links been made? And secondly, are there any countries around the world that are leading the way in terms of how to manage remote community broadcasting access? I was thinking maybe Canada, but wasn't sure.
In terms of the second question, international examples, I'm not sure if anyone has really resolved this, actually. The links to education or even health are really interesting for me. I heard this came out of the Indigenous Remote Media Festival recently, that PM&C is funding very expensive social return on investment study of the Indigenous broadcasting sector. I'll be curious to see the outcomes of it. I'm not sure it's a methodology that I think is right or necessarily agree with. The problem with tying these kind of grassroots media initiatives to social impact generally is that a lot of the things that you're trying to measure are intangible. Mm. It's around community building or culture. Having hardcore metrics for that is not necessarily feasible or reliable. And I worry if we start going down that path that we'll only fund things that make a claim to those outcomes. And once we start doing that, there's a danger that other types of content won't be funded, that can't find that evidence. And as a result, that, the innovative stuff won't come to the surface. And I did some research a few years ago on co-creative Indigenous content in remote communities. And a large proportion of the stuff that's tied to particularly AusCo funded type content, but tied or through Indigenous funding tied to these outcomes, is not necessarily made by Indigenous media organisations. A lot of it is kind of fly in, fly out community cultural development organisations. So I'm not sure that that's the best approach to creating a viable and strong Indigenous sector.
Yeah, Julian, you started off by talking about the 2 out of 3 rule and the 75% reach rule, and you were saying that that results in a very kind of limited conversation, centering around those things, and it strikes me that in a way that's kind of emblematic of the conversation around media policy, that the conversation around media policy goes on around the question of industry policy and technology. And when you bring up the subject of, having an audit for pluralism and diversity, well, that's a public stake. And we don't often talk about the public stakes in this area. So in a sense, it's the whole sort of media policy area, I think, is kind of very, very alienating and very, very owned by the interests that revolve around those particular areas. Now, I guess kind of the first, would you agree with that summation? And second, if that is the case, that there's a problem with kind of both the policy discussion and the public discussion around the policy, how might we need to go about changing that?
Well, I think that is a reasonable account of where the where media policy is. I'd agree with yours and Dennis's and others' comments about this is a field of policy which has been really owned, dominated by a small number of players. And if we think about the role of government itself in this, federal government, whether it's Labor or coalition government, has been terribly conflicted all the way through, because while government regulates this sector, and in Australia it's very clear that the federal government, this is something they need to do, they are also in the public sphere and dependent upon what these media businesses do and how they're presented. They're actually a major client of the commercial media as advertisers and providers of content, quite apart from their role with public sector broadcasting. So government has a deeply conflicted and complex role in this whole field, which makes it very, very difficult for it to present a kind of neutral view. I think that's precisely why it's incredibly important for people in the community and community organisations, in research and universities and elsewhere, in the consumer sector, which has really developed strongly in the communication space and is now starting to move into the media space. So, this is very, very important that we have strong voices arguing for public interest outcomes in this area. But it certainly is a very long haul. But at the same time, it's also a debate that's changing and it's changing quickly. I was thinking about Meg's remarks about how long we've been talking about some of these issues. How long governments have been talking about them and attempting to formulate responses to them. While all that has been going on, a huge amount, as we know, has been changing around us. And I think that in relation to commercial media anyway, the questions have changed. The legal and regulatory problems look similar, but what I've been trying to say is that I think what we're looking at now, through the prism of this very restrictive set of proposals, but what we have to think about is whether we see a future for commercial journalism in this country or not, and what does that look like? And I think that if we apply ourselves to that question, rather than getting bogged down in 75% or 2 out of 3 or 4 out of 5 or 4 out of 4 or whatever it may be, or whether the ACCC thinks that we can address questions of diversity through a test about substantially lessening competition, if we can focus on that larger strategic question, then I think we'll be well placed to contribute to argument in this area.
Thank you. Now, lady down here had a question.
Hi, I'm wondering about the idea of interests or rights, not just regionally, but age rights. So, for instance, the interests of future generations and of young people when it comes specifically to this issue of balance, whether balance could be seen as balance on evidence on questions like climate change, the number of jobs on renewables, coal, the wind power and renewables. And particularly if you think about the methodology of Lomberg, where human value is equated with GDP, which is a way of reinforcing the dominance of the global north.
Well, I'll take that one because I've thought a bit about it. Balance is one of about 6 elements that make up the concept of impartiality. And it's a particularly problematic element because lots of journalists interpret it to mean equal time or equal space. And that's what we call false balance. Balance, properly thought of, means following the weight of evidence. And that is the way in which the element of balance is built into, for example, the ABC's editorial policies around impartiality. Now, the practical difficulty is, in order to assess the weight of evidence, your ordinary lay journalist has got to acquaint himself or herself sufficiently with the evidence and acquire a sufficient understanding to make the assessment of weight. And at this particular point in time, the pull on journalists is all the other way. There's immense pressure on practitioners these days, particularly in commercial media and particularly in the newspapers, to get stuff up online quickly. The pressure to be first overrides the pressure to be right, much less the pressure to do a reflective and intelligent appraisal of evidence. So the ideal is, as I've set it out, and I exactly hear what you're saying in respect of climate change, it's nearly the paradigm case. Inoculation of children, another one. At the moment, because of the turbulence and the particular pressures in the profession, it's exceptionally difficult, except for those few privileged journalists, many of whom work for the ABC and some still work for Fairfax in particular, who have both the expertise and the time to apply the concept of balance as it should be applied.
I want to come in on this because I question whether it matters anymore, in that if you consider that 6 out of 10 Americans, I don't know what the figure is for Australia, but 6 out of 10 Americans get their news through social media, a large number of that is Facebook. And that is determined by algorithms based on what they've commented on or liked. Of course, we know that Facebook has recently sacked its human news team for robots, and that those algorithms are often bringing up content which is just plain lies. And that's what people think is news, and it's not news, and it's hardly surprising that we're seeing political polarization in America today.
Absolutely.
So you can do all the quality objective journalism that you want, but are people even going to see it?
Well, I was going to say I have nothing to add here, but now I do. I mean, I agree that that is a huge concern, but it's also an extremely fast-moving space and an inadequately researched one. Mm. I mean, I think anecdotally we all think the echo chamber effect of only getting the news that you think. We all think that that's probably happening. There's not a huge amount of really authoritative research to tell us that, but let's just go with the anecdotal impression first. But secondly, Facebook is very young. You know, it was a startup 10 years ago. This algorithm issue has developed quite fast, particularly in the last 6 months. And also in the last 6 months, we've had some other aggregators come to the market, including one that's Melbourne-based, Inkle, which I've been giving a trial to recently, who have as their selling point that they give you authoritative, serious news without the ads, aggregated in a way for the intelligent citizen. Now, I've been given the trial. It's not perfect. For example, it's not particularly good on local news for Melbourne, but it's good on national and fantastic on international. And it has agreements in place with the Washington Post and the New York Times and Crikey and The Conversation and The Age and a heap of other publishers. And money actually goes back to those publishers when somebody clicks on an article in Inkle. It's only about 10 cents an article. So for most people, you know, it's only going to be a few dollars a week. Now, I think that, I mean, I'm not saying Inkle's it, it might be something else, but, you know, the algorithm space is moving extremely fast, and the concern that Ellie just expressed, I totally agree, is a concern, but it's certainly not set in stone. It's emerged recently as a concern, and it has already changed in the last few months and will change again. So let's see where we are on that one next year.
Okay. Mm. Guys, that's the hour and 2 minutes, so our time has expired, but I'd like to thank you all for attending and taking part, and I would like you to join me in thanking our panellists. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.